This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Chidi Kurmar grew up in Chandigarh, India, where she heard a lot about America. Her family talked often of moving overseas to pursue a fresh start in the United States. Her parents had lived through the Indian partition. It's a bloody conflict that left them with lasting trauma. But Chidi's start in America wasn't what they expected. It began in the Bronx, in a tiny apartment in an immigrant neighborhood, and Chidi got lost between two cultures. Food and punk rock helped her navigate. Today, Chidi serves up that identity as a two-time James Beard Award-nominated chef at Garland Restaurant in Raleigh. She's the co-owner of that space, along with the music venues King's and Neptune's Parlor, and she sings and plays guitar in the rock band Birds of Avalon. Chidi Kurmar, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
It's really nice to be here.
Tell us more about, we're going to talk about your music and food, certainly, but I want to take you back now to your family. An interesting history. You actually grew up, were born in Pennsylvania, right?
I was. My parents and my sister lived in the U.S. Before we went back, and they moved to Berkeley, California, and then relocated to Pittsburgh, and maybe it was the harsh winters, but my mom was, I guess, decided that she didn't want to stay, and then got pregnant with me and thought, well, maybe we will stay. But at that point, it was too late because, you know, visas are difficult things to navigate. You can't really change your mind. So, yeah, we ended up back when I was a little baby.
So talk about that. Talk about growing up, essentially growing up in India.
Right? Yeah. You know, the early years. We moved straight to Chandigarh. My dad and my mom had, you know, jobs there. I mean, it was, you know, part of the renaissance of India and being a young country at that point. You know, Chandigarh was like the little shining jewel, a new city, which, you know, if you've been to India, you know there's not much that's new there. And it was it was intended to be a planned city. And I guess it's still kind of planned, you know.
Well, it was born in the 1950s, right?
I mean, yes.
It's actually constructed.
It was. It was the dream of our first, the first Indian Prime Minister, Nehru, wanted to have this modern city in India. And, you know, he was a Oxford-educated aristocrat. So he just really wanted these nice things for his new country and put out a call to architects. And actually, it was a Raleigh architect that got that bid. So
that's fascinating. And you just, well, I've obviously just learned that myself.
Me
but
too.
You only recently learned
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
right?
Chandigarh is credited to Le Corbusier, the French architect, the modernist, who did really design and finish the city, but the original plan was drawn, and the whole concept and the sort of the feel of the city was conceptualized by Novicki, who is the architect who designed, you know, Dorton Arena and Raleigh. And he was a Polish architect who was here, you know, back in the 40s, 50s. And he was the head of the architectural school at NC State. And just really bizarre thing that our friend Will Dodge told Paul in this past February, right before we had taken a trip there. And so he had been going back and forth. Novicki had been going back and forth to Chandigarh to get this project started. And on his third trip back, his plane crashed over the Libyan desert and he passed away. And then the project kind of became open again and Le Corbusier finished.
And this is at Chandigarh is in far northern India.
It is. It's about 2 hours north of New Delhi and in the foothills of the Kasauli Mountains.
And you said that you always had this kind of this attraction, affection for this city that you grew up in.
Yeah, it's just it had to me, you know, when we were growing up and I was a little girl, the attraction to America and Western things and Western music was always just a really strong pull. And there was something about Chandigarh that I knew that we lived in a city that was different than all of the other places around. And there was this little spark of newness and modernism and Western culture that, you know, was always a really big pull for my imagination.
And who knew that you would end up in the city where the very city, the man who designed it was.
I certainly didn't. I didn't know I'd ended up
would
there.
Go back? Do they have Confederate Monument? No, they wouldn't have that. Not at all.
No.
Not there. Your parents were academics, right? Both
yes.
Educated? What did they do?
They were both scientists. They education sort of saved them and was their way out, if you will. It was their way of becoming independent and self-sufficient. So they both got PhDs in biochemistry. My dad did a lot sooner than my mother, but she, you know, had her master's and then eventually did finish her PhD. And after moving to America, they kind of bounced around in a few different fields, but ended up in psychoneuroimmunology.
Would this be, forgive me for asking this and making what is going to be an assumption or presumption in this question, but for someone of your parents' generation, would it have been unusual for your mother to have gotten a degree like that?
Yes. I think that she... I know that she's the only person in her family, and she had eight other siblings. So there were nine of them, and actually both my mom and my dad had eight brothers and sisters, and she's the only one in their family who got that kind of education. And it was certainly not something that would have happened if she had had a more traditional life and a traditional childhood, but it was very... That doesn't happen often. Usually, and I don't know, but I want to say that still a lot of women in India get educated and they go pretty far, but it's almost like a credential to get a better husband, which is ridiculous.
But. Well, those are things, I mean, these are some of the cultural artifacts that that are all, you know, sort of make all these places as interesting as they are, although sometimes challenging to, you know, to navigate. Far northern India, so this is what had been, what is now Pakistan, was northern India. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Great Partition happened after World War II and after independence for India. And your parents got caught up in that.
Yeah. So the state of Punjab, which is where, you know, I'm from, was divided. And so western Punjab is now in Pakistan and eastern Punjab is in India. And my mother had grown up, born into Western Punjab, and her family's legacy and history was all kind of intermingled. You know, all those neighborhoods were not segregated. Muslims and Hindus lived next door to each other, and her mom's like adopted brother, if you will, was a Muslim like bigwig. It was, you know, just historically, the Muslims have been in India for hundreds and hundreds of years, and the tension isn't there until somebody really pokes it, you know? And partition was just a deal that was made by the British and the price that I guess they felt like we had to pay to have our own country back. And those borders were drawn by somebody who had the unfortunate task of doing something he had no business doing. And, you know, he had never been to those areas, and they rushed into this border that was drawn on a map in a boardroom somewhere in 6 weeks. And, you know, there are stories about the border having been traced around the ring of a wine glass that had left a stain on the map. So, yeah, and my dad was not in, he was in Ambala, which is used to be a British Army cantonment. And so he saw the tensions rise, but he also saw this, like, he was a part of, you know, the youth revolutionary spirit. You know, we get the British out. And at the same time, I don't know, I think it was a very complicated and scary and hopeful, you know, hopeful time in our history. There are... A lot of the families that are new to New Delhi, by new, I mean from 1947 on, were refugees or people that were affected by that.
Right. I mean, many people were just simply displaced in order to make all this happen. And, of course, there was an awful lot of violence in the process.
A million people died in the space of about a year and a half.
Including your mother's family.
Yeah. So my mom's family, she... And her two younger siblings, so they were the three youngest that were left. And then her oldest brother had come back from fighting on the British side in the war. I think he was stationed in Iraq or Iran. And the rest of them, everybody in the middle was either off at school or had gotten married and moved away. So they were, you know, everybody, all the Hindus had to leave. They just did. And so they just rushed into a camp that was temporary, and then everybody was taking trains or walking or taking carts, and they just took what they had, wore layers of clothes to, you know, have some possessions, and they weren't really allowed to take very much more. Boarded a train at night, and the train was stopped, and everybody was brutally slaughtered, except for just a few kids that hid and survived.
Their mother survived, and I think her mother, who was lost in the killings on the train, hid your mother and maybe a couple of your aunt.
Yeah, my mom never gave us all of the details, and she swore that she was going to write it all down. Yeah. And after she passed a couple of years ago, we did find some writings, but they were not, it was at night, and it was a sort of a cattle car kind of situation. Yeah. It was an open thing, and then memories are not reliable or too painful to articulate sometimes. Mm. So,
and it's a pain that she kept with her.
Always. It was always the front, I think, of her mind and the back of her mind. Yeah. And it was something that shared custody of her whole being forever. She was always deep in thought, and the amount of soul searching that she must have done to survive that and to negotiate a productive and, quote, normal life out of that without a structured cultural acknowledgement of that happening. It's still something that I think finally India is recognizing, that this was an actual tragedy and a something that now would be considered a worldwide, emergency. But at that point, I think it was maybe viewed as a price that had to be paid.
Talking with Chita Kumar today, a two-time James Beard-nominated head chef at Garland Restaurant. Our conversation will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Chita Kumar serves up Pan-Asian food with a Southern twist at Garland Restaurant in Raleigh. The food is rooted in her upbringing in India. She has been nominated twice for the James Beard Award, and when she's not at Garland or running her two other businesses, King's and Neptune's Parlor, she's on stage with the rock band Birds of Avalon. Chita Kumar, my guest today. Well, let's talk about moving. You finally did then move back, in your case, move back to the United States and found yourself in the Bronx, right?
Yeah, that was not the America we had been looking at pictures of, but here we were.
Well, tell me, before we get there, just what had you been looking? I mean, what was your vision of America? Where did you think you were going?
Well, my parents had some, like, magazines and catalogs, and it was all Hoover advertisements and wall-to-wall carpeting and, like, spaghetti and, like, beautiful, glass dishes. I don't know. It was just the concept of America in the other parts of the world that are not Western are just the sparkle. I don't know. You just have this like vision of everything is shiny and beautiful and perfect. And yeah, it is, compared.
But you were in the Bronx. Tell us what that was like. Where were you?
Our first apartment was on Gun Hill Road, and it was, we were across the street from a hospital. So it wasn't like, there's definitely worse neighborhoods, but it was not, it's a very isolating kind of place anyway. But then, we were kind of new to the country, and I was 8 and a half, and definitely wasn't, it was hard to figure out where to fit in, how to fit in, and how to even start, and how to make friends, and, what does it mean to be an American, and what does it mean to be here? Because everybody's very diverse.
Right.
And so, we had a classroom full of a lot of just, Irish families that were just there for generations or a few generations. And then people that had, their parents had moved, or a lot of people from Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic and a couple of Romanians here and there,
So diverse, but not a big Indian population.
No, not in that neighborhood. Flushing and Jackson Heights are where all the Indian folks are. There weren't really any Indian kids.
What did you do? Did you feel yourself sort of becoming two personalities or multiple personalities? How do you navigate that?
For sure. Even something really basic like speaking, I was very, very aware of my accent, and didn't really talk for a couple of months and watched a lot of TV and practiced, I guess, subconsciously, just how when you open your mouth, don't sound like that, you know, mm-hmm. pronounce your T's differently. I mean, I remember thinking this, and I had a home accent and I had a school accent.
Did you know that?
I did, and I was really worried about it. You know, I really thought, like, I'm just faking, you know, everybody's going to find out. And like, what if I can never reconcile these two things? And who am I? You know, what if one side catches the other? And it was, you know, it was definitely troubling.
And about how old were you at this point?
I mean, I was 8 and a half when we moved. So it probably took at least like two to three years before at least the accent part wasn't a big deal anymore.
And music was an important part of this, I understand.
Hugely. I mean, thank God for like New York radio at that point. Yeah. You know, I just discovered, you know, the Ramones and all of that kind of stuff. And we'd already, my dad had brought back some American music when we were in India. So I was always kind of listening to music alone in some room. So that was like a fantasy kind of escape, you know, eyeliner and leather jackets.
Yeah, I mean,
and
you know, create a persona.
Sure,
that, right?
Yeah, just
right?
something and to dream about.
Express a little bit of the anxiety.
Yeah,
it's not
exactly.
Too bad.
And it didn't really occur to me that all that stuff, you know, was like, this is the same city. You know, Manhattan is just a different borough. I mean, I knew that conceptually, but I didn't really know where things were going on.
And your name, we've been calling you Chithi, but in fact, that's not your given name, Chitra, right?
Right, Chitra is my name, and I didn't get donned Chidi until ninth grade. So that was another big thing. It's like, nobody can even say my name, you know? First day of school, roll call is like terrifying. Like, oh my God, here comes a big long pause before the teacher's looking at her list. Like, oh no, how is she going to say my name? And then everybody's going to turn around and look at me.
Well, so how did you go from Chitra to Chidi?
Well, Chidi was something that my friend Nancy, who was my Korean friend in ninth grade, like I started that school and we had just moved from one neighborhood to a little bit further north in southern Riverdale. And I thought, okay, this is my chance to like start over again. And I just kind of, we got along really well. And she was like, you know, I just can't say your name. We're just going to call you Chidi. Chidi, Chidi, Chidi. And she just started saying that and just kind of stuck.
Kind of worked out. What about your parents at this time? Are they both teaching?
They never taught. They were research.
Researching.
Yeah, they both worked in labs, and the whole thing is about grants, and it still is, you know. So they were always kind of fretting about the 2-year grant, 5-year grant, 7-year grant. So they were both working.
And as you're trying to navigate these identities, is one of the fantasies what you're going to be when you grow up? Are you thinking about that?
That was like a terrifying question, and it still is.
All right. At University of Massachusetts Amherst, you finally go there, right, to school, where, again, music can play an important part. There's a big music scene in
Massachusetts. Yeah, like immediately, it just turned out that the dorm that I got assigned to had a pirate radio station in the basement. So I did like a late night radio show once a week on Sunday nights, I think, and learned how to, you know, DJ. Very old board. And then...
Ooh, did it have pots?
It did. It had like, battery pots. It was so rad. I'm sure it's on eBay at some point.
Not anymore, actually.
No,
it's in a museum.
Yeah.
Maybe
that station is... No, I don't think it is. But then I ended up working at the official college radio station there. And so that was like a really neat way to, you know... I wasn't playing music, but I was kind of around it all the time. And there was a little tiny production studio, and I learned how to, you know, use the Vectron and like make carts and, you know, do a little bit of rudimentary recording.
It's technical stuff, but you're also on the air. This is you being out there, right? I mean, this is you talking out loud with whatever accent you happen to be affecting at the time, right? I mean, this means you've a certain degree of confidence to put yourself out there.
Yeah, I guess I never thought about that. And I didn't... my first show I did with a friend, and she liked to talk, so I didn't have to very much.
You're just queuing the records.
I was like picking out the records, and then eventually they offered me my own show. So I never talked very much, and I never really thought about it. But at that point, I think my accent was kind of established.
You knew how you
had
say it
one.
And your first guitar, 13 years old, or that's when you wanted one?
I My sister had one. I don't know why, but my parents had gotten her a little acoustic thing, and she never played, but I started to, and I just really wanted an electric guitar, and I just wasn't feeling it, you know, and my parents were like, no, you know, so I just kind of let that go.
Yeah.
But when I got to school, there was a dude who lived down the hall who had a Jackson, this like hideous pointy metal guitar and a really, you know, bad amp. But I borrowed it and I just.
So punk.
It was like, not even, it was sorry. Like really suburban metal.
So anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I borrowed it, but that didn't really work out either. So I just kind of like abandoned the whole thing until I moved to Raleigh.
Because music is still a part of it, but food, obviously a big part. Had that played a part in your upbringing? I mean, starting in the Bronx and now that you're away at college, how big a part does food play in all of this?
Every day, you know, all the time. From when I was like four, you know, my grandmother lived with us and she made dinner almost every night, and my mom was working, so my mom would cook on the weekends. And I would always be kind of hanging out in the kitchen. And then when we moved to America, it was my job to start dinner when my mom was working. So as soon as I'd get home, she would call me, make sure I got home okay, and then give me instructions on what the...
So you were cooking Indian cuisine then? You weren't trying to convert everybody? To...
I think I did make spaghetti, but I'm sure there was cumin in the sauce.
There's a thought. Did you enjoy it?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, you know, I think I'm sure I complained about it sometimes. Yeah. I don't feel like washing the rice, you know, but I always had to wash the rice. But it was definitely, you know, I read cookbooks and I would, we went to the Yonkers Library for some reason, and I would always go and find the NME and Melody Maker and then go look at the cookbook section. Those were my two like journeys, and then check out some Nancy Drew books or something. I don't know.
And you started managing bands.
I did. So, you know, working at the radio station at UMass, I kind of became more involved in like promotions and live music presentation and all that kind of stuff. And managing bands just, I don't know, it just kind of like I wanted to help the bands that I liked get somewhere. And it was a very strange career choice for me, but I did.
Why would you say that?
I think I was probably just trying to live vicariously, and you know, I'm just not like a very outgoing kind of person. I'm like, schmoozing is such a part of that job, and the music industry is kind of, you know, disgusting in a lot of ways. I mean, there's a lot of brash and braggadocious kind of thing about it, and I'm just not really.
Were you good at it though? I mean, maybe did you counter program and come at it a different way?
I guess I had a little success for a couple of years, and I was good at like being passionate about the people that I believed in.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes that the braggadocio usually makes up for the fact that you don't really care. So
right,
if you actually care, you don't need all that.
I really did. I mean, I really loved the bands I worked for.
Then tell us about Cherry Valance, because that is, you started that band with the man who would be your husband, Paul Seiler.
Yeah, so we were already together at that point, and he had been in a couple of other bands, and I had started playing guitar and played with some folks who were very patient with me as I was learning. And then we started this band, and it just kind of evolved. And we bought a prison van, an ex-prison van from the state auction lot, and just got in the van and started touring. And
what kind of music?
Just rock and roll, I guess. It was, you know, little edges of punk rock and garage music, but nothing really very... we don't stay in genres very well.
Again, you're putting yourself out there, and you talked about sort of not being that kind of person. You don't like the schmooze. You don't like the being out there. Do you like to perform? Did you like to perform then?
I loved and hated it. I really loved the nerves every day. I was playing guitar. I was just sort of like the long-haired person on side, you know, stage left at that point. Yeah. And I wasn't singing, so it was, you know, I just found a way to be vocal without opening my mouth, I guess.
Well, that's a good trick. Talk about Birds of Avalon. That's the band you're in now. I know you're in a little bit of a hiatus, but that's a band that a lot of people know and has been around for a while. How did that get started?
Well, there was you know, Cherry Valance was getting pretty successful, and but I was just very dissatisfied with it creatively, I guess. I was at a point where I wanted to do something that was a little bit more musical, mm-hmm. and I just wanted to start over, mm-hmm. as I am prone to do, either move or or do something else. And we started that band, and it's kind of evolved over time, reflecting the kind of music that we were into at the, you know, at that moment.
Also writing music, right?
Yeah. I mean, writing music in a different way over time. In the beginning, it was all very guitar-y and all very riff-based. And then as, I don't know, it just became a little bit more fun to be random about how we created stuff. Mm. We would just practice. And then we were recording with Mitch Easter in Kernersville at Fidelitorium. And I just kind of got really into the studio thing. And he was generous enough to, like, teach me some stuff.
Well, Mitch knows a few things.
Just a couple of things.
And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a producer who's been around.
Yeah,
and
he just has this really natural knowledge, and just his everything about it is just very easy. So he makes you comfortable. He doesn't make you feel stupid if you don't know anything, you know, which I didn't. But I just started learning from him a little bit. And then being in the studio became a part of our writing process, which was really convenient when we got super busy with these businesses. We would just set up and play and record a whole bunch of, like, very stream of consciousness stuff, and then go back and edit and hack some songs together, which was all just studio time.
Well, I want to play a little sample of one of your tracks. This is Birds of Avalon. This would be the cut Eyesore. That's a little bit of Eyesore, the Raleigh-based rock band Birds of Avalon. With me in the studio is guitarist and vocalist T.T. Kumar, also a two-time James Beard-nominated chef, co-owner of Garland, co-owner of King's and Neptune's Parlor in Raleigh. So where were you in the sort of the restaurant and the business side of your life as Birds of Avalon was coming along? Which came first?
Birds of Avalon definitely predated all of this stuff, although Paul and two other friends had started the first iteration of King's back in, 1999. Mm-hmm. And I was involved, but not in any, like, sort of official capacity. So they were in a different location. And we were touring pretty heavily, like, starting in 2004. Mm-hmm. And so we did that for a while until, you know, that King's, that building got torn down, and we didn't do anything with that stuff for like 3 years, and then found the space on Martin Street where we currently are.
And then was it King's and then Neptune's? Did you?
Actually, it was Neptune's first, and then King's like a month and a half later. So we were in heavy build out mode for the whole first half of 2010.
I mean, that's a lot of business skill now that you're having to bring to this. Learning as you go?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Always.
And that was a time, too, when Raleigh was just coming to life again.
Right? Yeah. I think, you know, it's got this rapid progression, but there were a lot of people and things that, you know, step by step,
sure,
kind of building the downtown culture and community we have now.
And tell us about Garland, then.
So Garland was this the middle space in that building that we got the lease on, and it had already been a restaurant before. So, but it didn't look anything like what I wanted, you know, and it was also huge.
Looked like the Bronx.
Yeah, a little bit burned out, yeah. It was just not the space that I had pictured in my head, and I don't even know why I got it into my stupid mind to open a restaurant, but I did. And I just wanted a small thing. I really wanted a stationary food truck kind of situation. Mm-hmm. But here is this giant dining room and built out kitchen. And I just, the bridge between where what I knew, which was nothing, and what I knew would take to run that kind of space was just vast and terrifying. So it took me a couple of years to even get the gumption to think mm-hmm. about it and started working on it. And, it took also 2 years to just get Kings and Neptunes and figure out all the little details about how to do that. And we started working on Garland in 2013. And I thought, hey, let's just make this a window first. And we can just be working on the dining room, do the build out in a sort of a gradual way, hire half the staff. So just have the kitchen be, figure out how to manage that thing.
Well, we'll find out how you did all that and what happened next when my conversation with Chiti Kumar continues, owner and chef of Garland Restaurant, also Neptune's Parlor and King's. Just ahead, we're going to hear more about that. But first, let's hear another track from Birds of Avalon. This is Cycle Thief from their 2017 album, Operator's Midnight. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Chiti Kumar, two-time James Beard-nominated head chef of Garland Restaurant in Raleigh. There she serves up Pan-Asian cuisine with a Southern twist, co-owns the space along with King's and Neptune's Parlor, also in Raleigh, a guitarist in the rock band Birds of Avalon, and now a guest on The State of Things. Your life is complete.
It is. I can stop now.
Tell me about the cuisine. What did I just say? I said something like Pan-Asian cuisine with a Southern twist. What did I mean by that?
I'm not sure what you meant.
I don't know. I have no idea.
It's kind of, sometimes it's hard to describe. I mean, it's really the New South, I guess. There's a lot of influences, but really the anchoring thing is our ingredients here. We're just lucky to have such a great agricultural situation. And the ingredients, the things that are, the crops that are grown here are very similar to northern India, where I grew up. Mm. And so, purple top turnips and mustard greens and, tomatoes and okra and eggplant. I mean, it's like the same seasonal stuff. And we would go to the market when I was a little girl there. The farmer's market looks a little different, but the crops don't,
That's interesting,
So, I kind of grew up cooking seasonally anyway. And Here, all of those ingredients work with those flavors. So,
do you have those in northern India? Those giant drumsticks that look like okra.
We don't. And are they good for your thyroid?
I don't know. I think they just look like they've got a kind of glandular problem.
Yeah,
they're big. They're giant.
They are. They're delicious, but we don't. Yeah, that's a Southern Indian
thing. Well, so that's it. Did you think when you were thinking about the cuisine for Garland, was it, I'm just going to do what I know, or were you a little more thoughtful about, I'm here in the...
The initial anchor was what I know. Yeah. And, and what I like. But I like a lot of stuff. I really like to eat. And so I started thinking about the things that I grew up with and I knew how to make. And then I started thinking about, how that I'm not a trained chef and everybody who's trained knows about French food and how to cook French food. And then I started thinking about mother sauces. So I started thinking about my mother's sauces, and that became the anchor. So yogurt and tamarind chutney and green chutney and all of those things that were always on our table, the condiments and then also the ingredients that get used in all of our marinades. And so that became sort of the anchor point, and then it just branched out from there.
So you can grow up kind of knowing how to cook if you're lucky and you're interested, but finance, that's a whole other thing. I mean, talk about being involved in these three businesses all of a sudden. That must have been daunting at first.
It still is. Every day, that is definitely like something I need to learn a lot more about. Mm-hmm. But I like math.
But it's a lot. I mean, you were married. Were you new? How long had you been married before you know, open up these businesses?
6 years.
Okay.
5 years, I think.
Because it can
like
be.
That.
I mean, it seems to me that can be a pretty stressful time.
Very, very stressful. Very challenging. Yeah. And you know, Paul and I, because we'd always kind of we'd played music together. We were touring together, so we were in a van together, but we also were with other people. So we've had this like duality to our relationship from day one. But by far, the most challenging thing has been to do this business.
Well,
together.
And even with the band, I mean, everything is additive, right? I mean, in other words, every gig is another check, and you split it. And not having a gig is a lack of a check. Mm-hmm. But now you're talking about, you know, mortgages, debt, you know, all sorts of things. It's different now. You're
it's
in a
terrifying.
Position where you can lose, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, the first 2.5 years of the restaurant were a lot of tears, you know, and just severe, like just terror. You know, we really had everything to lose in that situation, and a lot of, you know, physical and emotional, just being pushed to the limits, you know, working all the time. And, you know, we still work all the time, but then it was like first in, last out kind of thing. And then how do you manage a business when you're actually just the person who's like running the kitchen all the, you know, all day, every day. So just, you know, having faith, and Paul is like an eternal optimist, and he was we just threw ourselves into it and learned so much about ourselves and our relationship too, and really had to figure out some structure in which to, this is when we can talk about this and we can't talk about it at this point. And, you know, separating what is external stress from what might be considered like inability to be in a relationship, you know, anymore.
Well, that's very wise. That's not an easy thing to figure out, especially under duress.
Yeah,
to
it took some time.
To realize that those walls need to actually be there.
Well, you know, definitely. And it's really, I credit him with a lot of it because he is just insanely patient and the nicest person I've ever met. And it also was like a lot of support from the friends in our community. And, you know, somebody like Ashley Christensen tells you, don't give up, you know, it kind of stays with you.
Well, that's telling right there. I mean, the food scene in all of North Carolina, whether you're talking about Asheville or the Triangle or Wilmington, I mean, it's exploding, right?
Yeah.
And it has been for a while. But it seems to me my closest experience is Durham, and I know, you know, a lot of the restaurant owners here. My sense is they get along pretty well together, which shocks me. And you're just talking about Ashley Christensen, who's, you know, a beard winner. she's been at it for a while now, a lot of businesses, encouraging the competition.
Yeah. I don't think that any of us think about it as competition.
No.
I certainly don't. And I think that the most joyous moments of the last few years have been when Ashley and Matt Kelly and I and, like, you know, just all of our little community get together, and whether it's planned or impromptu, and just kind of hang out. I mean, I don't think we ever see each other as somebody that we're competing with. It's more like we're all in this giant boat together.
Well, the giant boat together is interesting because a number of people I've talked to said, no, what this does is kind of brands this place and the food scene, and it helps the entire food scene grow. And so the more great restaurants there are, the more likely people are going to travel from far and wide to get here. So there's plenty of opportunity.
I mean, it's more fun when you have a great culture that's evolving, and it brings you know, more farmers to our area, and it just like who wants to live in a desert, you know?
Yeah.
And it just makes everything be rich and full, and like it's nice to get off work and go down the street to St. Rock's and have oysters, you know? Like, we didn't have that a few years ago, and we all want to I think we all want to live in a place where we can call a friend and commiserate or congratulate or celebrate together. It's just like, you don't want to do this alone.
For all of your success, it's interesting because you talked about earlier, you said, well, look, I'm not a trained chef. I'm going to do this. There was a time when you were battling a sense of imposter syndrome.
Oh,
do you
that,
think?
Like today? I mean, I think that it's always kind of there. And I just did this. There's a series of events that are put together by the Southern Foodways Alliance, and it's called Brown in the South. And it's a group of Indian chefs that live in the South and cook in the South. And we were just talking about this. We had our event a couple of weeks ago in Nashville, and how that imposter syndrome is sort of always there, you know. And we were speculating whether it's what comes first, that thing, that feeling, because we're new in the country in a way. So we, you know, we talked about this earlier, but am I pretending to be American or am I an American? Am I pretending to be a chef or am I a chef? I mean, after a while, if you spend enough time doing something, you kind of become that. But then there's always so much more to go and to learn. So I'm not sure.
Well, and I understand that I know you lost your mom a few years ago, and that actually changes the way, or has changed the way, you connect with your food and your culture.
Definitely. I was not prepared for that loss. It was not, she wasn't sick or anything. And it just literally happened one day. And after that, you know, a part of the grieving process was understanding what connection she had to me and what things I asked her to hold for me. You know, so she was the carrier of our culture to me, and she held all the family recipes, and she was my reference for a lot of recipes and, you know, techniques. And so when all of a sudden she was gone, she was my conduit to being Indian, and then I had to figure it out on my own, and really have the confidence to say, okay, well, I can't ask her. Let me just think about this, and what would she do if she was making this right now? And what did she do? Like, can I remember it without her physically being there? So, you know, it forced me to become to own some of that stuff that I kind of had relegated to
her. Well, that's an interesting, you use that image of the conduit. It's a passage, and that strikes me as an image of free passage back and forth, in and out of various cultures. Did you feel that you really, so now I can't just keep running back and forth because there's nobody there to remind me?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's almost like, well, this part I know I can rely on. You know, that's going to be safe. That all of that information is here, and I'll go back and ping ping ping, and learn about all this other stuff, and then I can always grab that from her. But then it was like, okay, I really have to find a place for where does this fit into how I think about food and how I think about myself and, you know, cultural identity and ethnic identity. You know, all of that stuff is but it's. The fact is that it's evolving, and it's not really the same. Right. And my relationship with my former home in India is not static either.
Right.
So,
well, that was going to be my next question. Did it give you an impulse to sort of hold more firmly to the tradition, or because, as you say, you know, it's about fusion, it's about evolving, it's about coming down here and seeing what the ingredients are. Mm-hmm. But did you have an impulse to sort of hold on and say, no, we wouldn't do it that way. I can't do it that way today in my kitchen.
Well,
because in India, this is how we do it.
It's funny because I think I thought about things a little bit more rigidly before. And now there's a little bit, I don't know why, but there's a little bit of freedom because, I mean, it could all just go any day. So just make it something that feels right at the moment. And I don't know, I think about things as a lot less permanent in terms of food. So a dish is just a dish, and then if it doesn't work, it goes away.
Yeah, and I guess in any kitchen, I mean, we talk about authentic, but in every real kitchen, there's a lot of improvisation that goes on every day, depending on how long that's been in the refrigerator, because I have to use it today.
Right.
So that's now part of this recipe, right?
Or like, oops, there was a frost, and you're not going to get that. You know, you ordered it. You thought you were going to have it today, but it just didn't come in. So
tell me about the James Beard nomination, and congratulations twice now. Does that change things at all?
It does, but not in the sense that you might picture it or that I pictured. I mean, it's not something that you try to get. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't apply for this thing, and it just kind of was not on my radar. It happened, and it kind of really just knocked my socks off. What it does is made me think about my decisions and my choices as a chef and a business owner and an employer and a person in a community who really is buying ingredients. You know, how do you source, and just sort of like.
But you'd been doing that.
We
right?
had been. Yeah. We had been, and it was very affirming to be able to say yes. You know, it's. That was the right choice. Mm-hmm. These are the right choices, or these choices feel good, and they are responsible, and it really makes all of those little decisions become more important, even more important than they were before, and it makes you kind of stand up a little bit straighter and take your job seriously. Not really yourself, but really what you're trying to do. It's just a restaurant. There's a million of them. But
again, it gets to who you can collaborate with. You talked about the food ecosystem here, the number of farmers, the amount of sustainable agriculture, and the way in which it's networked. Just to be able to take advantage of all that is
absolutely
kinda great.
You know, it's an economic power and it's an economic responsibility at the same time. And both of those things, I think, when you have the very humbling recognition that comes with a foundation like the James Beard Foundation, which has a historic component to it, you realize that it's more of a responsibility than like something that you can just sit back and rest on your laurels. Like, hey, I'm so great. It's not about being great. It's about doing great things.
Yeah, with a lot of people around you. Well, does it open up any other opportunities for you though? Do things change in that way?
Yeah. My schedule has gotten busier. There's a lot more travel and just an opportunity to cook with people that you really admire and learn so much more, and all of the little ways that other kitchens operate, and almost like a day-to-day thing, like an hour-to-hour. How do you structure things, and how do you, again, the sourcing is important, and really how do you manage a staff, and how do you keep people engaged and inspired, your guests and your crew and yourself, and work-life balance, and it changes your job. It really does.
You're going to unbalance your life anymore and open up any new places?
Oh God, no? We'll see. I don't know. Yeah. I think a little personal balance needs to come first.
All right, we'll give you that for just a moment or two. Chiti Kumar, 2-time James Beard nominated head chef at Garland Restaurant in Raleigh, co-owner of that space along with King's and Neptune's Parlor in Raleigh, and sings and plays guitar in the rock band Birds of Avalon. Chiti, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.